books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and this week we are combining the worlds of music and literature. We'll hear about a 32-hour-long biography of Bob Dylan, get some book recommendations from a former captain on Nevermind the Buzzcocks, plus we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. All that and more on today's Read On. But first, on today's Read On, let's hear from a couple who really have combined literature and music. Beth and Ben Please are the Bookshop Band, and I met them at an evening event called A Feast for the Ears.
We are the foxes working for you. Bring out your boxes before you settle down. We are the foxes working for you.
Hello, I'm Beth Please.
I'm Ben Please. The Bookshop Band started as a... Well, we weren't the Bookshop Band, we were just Ben and Beth, and we actually had a third member, Poppy, in Bath, and we started as a collaboration with between us three songwriters and a bookshop in Bath called Mr. B's Emporium of Reading Delights. Their big thing is fiction and new fiction. They have a wonderful series of curated author events, and they wanted to kind of, I guess, spice them up from being just the author comes in, reads a bit, signs a few books, to creating a themed event with sort of themed food and talking about other books in the theme and just trying to broaden it out. And as part of that, they wanted to do some music. And so we came in as songwriters to basically as a songwriting challenge for us to write some songs for those events. We'd read the book and, inspired by the book to play back to the author in this small room above this bookshop, and that's how it started, and that's how it continues, really.
Running wings round covers more ground than foxes in a big rush, jumping on a night bus. City lights glow like a light show, keeping strange hours, smelling all the flowers.
How do you avoid spoiling a book?
I think our responses to these books are very much just our response. So they're not necessarily retellings of the story. There might be slight hints that just because they've got in there, but I like to think we don't give away too much, and we like to give an essence of the book perhaps rather than a retelling of the book. We never know how the songs are going to come out, but we don't want to spoil it for people.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, writing a song about first lines.
We were asked by the Verb programme on Radio 3 for their first show of the year in January a few years ago. The theme was beginnings, and so they asked us to try and write a song using the beginnings of books. And this was a song we had to play live on the radio, and we didn't write it until the last possible moment. And I kind of woke up in a cold sweat thinking, actually, this is going to be a really difficult thing to do because all these wonderful first lines of books are not going to rhyme with each other or fit into a neat rhythmic structure. Mm. So we printed out every first line we could find and got sellotape and bits of string and actually had a lot of fun putting it together.
One of my favourites, which I wasn't expecting to be a favourite, was The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell. And I think before I became a member of the Bookshop Band, I didn't even think that I particularly liked fiction, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but I was in my head, it was, yeah, I like non-fiction. And then we had to read these books, and they were all brilliant books. You know, they were curated by the bookshop. We met the authors, and we really got into that world of fiction. And again, I was like, well, I don't really think, I'm not really into fantasy. And then read this book, The Bone Clocks, and I just think the different worlds and the different characters and the way he told it from each character's point of view and switched and got rhythm into it. It was almost poetic, a lot of it. And so, yeah, appealed to my kind of musical sense, I think.
recently, I've particularly enjoyed Underland, so going into non-fiction, so normally we do fiction just because that's Mr. B's sort of particular passion, but we were asked to write for the launch of Robert McFarlane's Underland, and that's him journeying in into underground places around the world, from like caverns and underneath cities to glaciers to caves or underground rivers, and just following his journey into sort of some quite terrifying places and feeling his terror, but also the wonder and beauty. It was a journey into somewhere where I'd be too cautious to be as adventurous as he was. And so that was a real treat. That was a real reading treat, to be carried into these places. And the song that came out of that, it takes me back to those places. So I really enjoy that.
Few events. We're doing a breakfast show every morning at 9:30, and basically it's us chatting to authors who we may have met the night before, and we've got them to come along to our breakfast show to talk about what they're going to be doing at the festival. So it's quite an informal thing with croissants and coffee and tea, and just a relaxed setting with us asking fairly ignorant questions about them, but interspersing with some music. And then we have an event with Ken
Cockburn,
who is a wildlife bird poet, and we're going to be singing some songs inspired by birds. We've done a few songs about snow geese, so there'll be some snow geese songs. And then we're doing an event with Jackie Morris, who's an artist who actually worked with Robert McFarlane on The Lost Words, which is a brilliant book, illustrated kind of poems about words that were taken out of the Oxford Junior Dictionary, and they were words like acorn and bluebell and conquer. So that book's a brilliant book, but she's actually coming, Jackie Morris is coming, to talk about her new book, which is called House Without Windows. And the book is, it's not her own story, but she's illustrated it and she's written an introduction forward to it. And it's by Barbara Fawcett Newell, or the other way around, but she was a 12-year-old girl who wrote this book in 1927, or first got published in 1927, and then didn't really get republished, hasn't been republished recently at all. And so Jackie Morris has brought this child's story back into life, and we're going to be writing a song inspired. We started writing a song inspired by that to play next weekend.
Isn't 9:30 awfully early for a book festival?
Is that awfully early for a musician, I think? I think Adrian, the festival director, had it in his head that it would be a good way to get free croissants to a number of people, which I think draws the authors in for sure. But I don't think any musician should have to sing before 11 o'clock in the morning. So it's, unfortunately, it's gone down rather well and we've been asked to do it again.
Yes, but we do have a 2-year-old, so we're often up quite early anyway. So
yeah, we've been up for 12 hours before that.
Now, if anyone wants to find out more, where can they go?
Well, we have a website, which is thebookshopband.co.uk, and that's generally got a fairly up-to-date listings of where we're playing. And we also have a Twitter, The Bookshop Band, and Facebook, and all the usual social media. But we'd much rather they came and find us at a gig. That would be fun.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Still to come on this Read On music special, a biography of Bob Dylan and some book recommendations from Phil Jupitus. But first, let's take a trip to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some new gems.
First this week, we have Glorious Exploits by Ferdia Lennon, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
We set out with 6 skins, 4 of water and 2 of wine, a pot of olives and 2 blocks of that smelly cheese Ma makes. Ah, It's a beautiful island we have. And sometimes I think the factory closing is my chance to shake things up. That I might just leave Syracuse and find myself a little place by the sea. No more dark rooms, clay and red hands, but the sea and the sky. And when I come home with a fresh catch slung over my shoulder, she'll be there, whoever she may be, waiting for me and laughing. That laugh, I hear it now, and it sounds to me a soft and delicate thing. Why, Gellon, I feel so good today. Gellon looks at me. He's handsome, with eyes the colour of shallow sea when the sun shines through it. He opens his mouth to speak, but nothing comes. He's often down, Gellon. Sees the world as if it's filtered through smoke. No brightness to anything. We walk on.
It's 412 BC, and Athens' invasion of Sicily has failed catastrophically. Thousands of Athenian soldiers are held captive in the quarries of Syracuse, starving, dejected, and hanging on by the slimmest of threads. Lampo and Gellon are local potters, young men with no work and barely two obols to rub together. With not much to fill their time, they take to visiting the nearby quarry, where they discover prisoners who will, in desperation, recite lines from the plays of Euripides in return for scraps of bread and a scattering of olives. And so an idea is born. The men will put on Medea in the quarry, a proper performance to be sung of down the ages, because, after all, you can hate the Athenians for invading your territory, but still love their poetry. But as the performance draws near and the audacity of their enterprise dawns on them, it becomes difficult to distinguish between enemies and friends. And Lampo, whose ambitions have never stretched beyond having enough coin for the next jug of wine, finds his aspirations elevated, his heart entangled, and his courage tested in ways he could never have imagined. Glorious Exploits is an exhilarating and fiercely original story of brotherhood, war, and art.
Even though the Athenians are crushed, their ships firewood and their unburied dead food for our dogs, there are still hoplites on patrol, just in case. Diocles gave a speech not yesterday about how you can never tell with these Athenians. A fresh batch could arrive any day. Maybe he's right. Most of the Spartans have left. Word is they're heading for Athens itself, all set to siege it upright and proper, end this war. But there's still a few about, homesick and useless. In fact, four of them walk ahead of us now, their red cloaks trailing behind them like wounds. Morning! They look back. Only one of them salutes. Arrogant, these Spartans, but I'm feeling good. Down with Athens! Two of them salute now, but there's no life behind it. They look tired and sad, like Gellon. I feel so happy today. I can't explain it, but it's some feeling. Those are the best ones. The ones you can't explain. And we haven't even fed the Athenians.
Glorious Exploits by Ferdia Lennon is read by the author and runs for 8 hours 16 minutes.
We have one of the latest books in the Simon Scarrow Eagles of the Empire series, with more to follow in the future. This one is called The Honour of Rome.
There's a boat approaching, Centurion Macros said, and pointed down the river. The grey-streaked curls above his brows stirred in the cold breeze as he squinted over the water. The others on the deck of the Dolphin turned to see a small low craft being propelled by 4 men at the oars, while another 3 sat in the stern and 1 more stood in the bows, holding a rope to steady himself. It had rounded a bend in the Thamesis, no more than 1/4 mile away, and was approaching fast. Macros swiftly calculated that it would soon overtake the sluggish merchant vessel, carrying his wife and himself upriver to Londinium. Although the men wore no armour, and Macro could see no spears or other weapons, something about their demeanour caused a wary tingle at the back of his neck.
Are we in any danger?
He turned to his wife, Petronella, a heavily built woman with an oval face fringed with dark hair, who was only a little shorter than Macro. They had been together for a few years now, and she knew that, though Macro had left the army, his senses were well honed to detect any potential threat.
I doubt it. But better be safe than sorry, eh?
15 years after he fought Britannia's barbarians during the Roman invasion, Centurion Macro is back. There is restlessness among the tribes that have supposedly accepted Roman rule, while the atmosphere in Londinium is menacing. Newly discharged from the army, Macro is missing the drama of battle, but soon he will need all his courage and skills to survive. Gangs of thugs run the city. When Macro resists, a brutal attack serves as punishment and warning. But the mobsters have made a deadly error. Britannia's veterans stand with their own, and Macro will soon have a powerful ally, Prefect Cato. They will fight to the death to protect the honour of Rome.
He left Petronella to watch the approaching boat and addressed the captain of the merchant vessel in a casual tone. A word with you, Andricus. The captain caught the warning look in Macro's eye and followed him aft to where the baggage lay, covered by a goatskin. Macro folded the covering back and undid the latch of the chest holding his kit. Reaching inside, he rummaged for his sword belt, then quickly buckled it on, adjusting it so that the handle of the sword settled into its usual place against his hip. He handed a spare sword belt to Andricus.
Put it on.
They look harmless enough. Are weapons really necessary?
Let's hope not. But in my experience, it's better to have them at the ready and not need them than not have them ready and need them.
Andricus took a moment to digest the comment before he took the belt and hurriedly fastened it around his slim hips.
Now what? Let's see what they do.
The Honour of Rome by Simon Scarrow is read by Jonathan Cable and runs for 12 hours 29 minutes.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Spencer Lee has been broadcasting on BBC Radio Merseyside since 1972. He's also written biographies of Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Buddy Holly, and indeed, Bob Dylan. And it was the latter of those books, Outlaw Blues, that was recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden just after lockdown ended. And Spencer spoke to Red Sail.
Spencer Lee, welcome to Read On.
I'm very pleased to be with you. I'm delighted that someone's reading my book out. I find it extraordinary because it is 500 pages.
Well, it's a fascinating subject, and I'm sure our narrator will be enthralled by the book as he's reading it.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I hope it entertains him too. There's a lot of jokes in the book because Dylan is a very quirky character.
He's a very quirky character. He continues to tour, to write music, and to constantly confound his critics, who love to call him an enigma. But in this book, right from the very beginning, you say you're not going to use that description.
I never use the word enigma. I have all these little rules, really. But enigma means you don't know what it means. You can't explain it. And a writer shouldn't be using the word enigmatic. You've got to look behind it and say, why is this person so strange? What's motivating him?
And you offer us an alternative, a quote that Bob Dylan used in an interview in 1987 with Sam Shepard. You always know who you are, I just don't know who I'm going to be.
Yeah, he says many things like that. Very like David Bowie, really. He often said things that sounded very profound, and in many cases they actually were. But he likes to keep people guessing. And I think Dylan was somebody like that. He was confident in his own mind as to who he was and what he wanted to do. And if the public didn't go with him on it, so be it. That was the way that he worked. And so in 1965, he came to Britain for the first time. And that was wonderful. I saw him in Liverpool. It was fantastic. He was doing some songs that hadn't even been released at the time. So it was just extraordinary to just hear somebody doing those songs live. But then the next year, he came back with his electric band. And although the audience had applauded him throughout the previous year, this time people were shouting at him. People were leaving the concert early. They were flinging their programs to the ground and walking to a folk club that was actually opposite the Odeon in Liverpool. And I'm glad to say I was one of the ones that stayed till the end. I mean, I just thought it was marvellous. And the reason he'd upset them is that he was a folky, or was thought to be a folky, and so people were expecting acoustic music. And this time he had brought a group who later became the band with him. And he was rocking out loud and playing fast. And the audience, a lot of them, didn't like it. And so it was very, very interesting to be in a room where you would think that everybody would be turned on by him, and a lot of people were being turned off. And when I did the book, one of the things that I wanted to do was say how many other artists had actually acted like this. They couldn't care less what the public thought of them. They were going to do what they wanted to do. So I went back to Hector Berlioz and Symphony Fantastique and Stravinsky and the like. And I have about a dozen examples before we actually get to Bob Dylan.
Yeah, there's almost a sense with him that he doesn't trust his audience, that if he's getting too successful, he feels that he needs to rip it up and start again and challenge his audience to like him in his new incarnation.
Well, yes, I mean, most artists, of course, have a certain limited amount of talent, and they're so glad that somebody likes what they're doing that they keep on doing it for the rest of their careers. And we see an awful lot of 60s bands and the like on tour, which are perfectly fine, but they're doing songs they recorded 50 years ago. And who can blame them? They found a winning formula, and that was that. But that was never Dylan's way. He just wanted to move on to something else. He was immensely creative, particularly in the early years, and he was moving from one thing to another. And so we have all these different periods in his life, almost like Picasso, where he changes what he's doing completely. I mean, he does have his Christian period in the late 70s, where he makes three Christian albums, which a lot of people don't like at all. They think that that's the sort of nadir of his work. But I actually think there's some really good stuff in there. Songs like Precious Angel and Every Grain of Sand, some marvellous stuff in there. But it was a phase he was going through, and he went on to something else after that. So it's very interesting, all the different stuff that he's done.
You dig back into his early life and his early musical influences. And most Bob Dylan fans will know about Woody Guthrie and Hank Williams and Elvis. But you also say that he was influenced by a host of other artists, including Blind Willie McTell, who, of course, is the subject of one of his songs.
Blind Willie McTell is a truly superb song. Blind Willie McTell is not really known these days. Well, he was recording in the 50s, but he did make some records in the 1930s, his best-known records. And he has, even though there are crackles and hisses on those records, they are still very, very good records. And he had a voice that, had he been recorded in today's technology, you would be thinking, this is a man who can sing like Roy Orbison. He was not like a blues singer at all, really. He had a much greater talent than that. And it's great that Bob Dylan was influenced by him. And he sings this great song, which incidentally, in his typical perverse manner, he wrote it around the time of Empire Burlesque and decided not to put it on the album. So, I mean, why do you leave your best song off the album and you don't put it on the next one or the next one? And in the end, it ends up as one of his outtakes, but it's just a magnificent song.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned, all the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem. I travel through East Texas, where many martyrs fell. And I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell.
The unmistakable Bob Dylan singing Blind Willie McTell.
And as befits any artist Bob Dylan has a wide range of influences, and you trace his love of motorbikes and maybe his inability to smile when he's on stage back to his being very much influenced by James Dean and Marlon Brando.
Well, that's what he would have grown up with when he was 13 or 14. You'd have seen those two unsmiling characters in the movies, Rebel Without a Cause, The Wild One with Marlon Brando, On the Waterfront. And they were very cool characters. People wanted to dress like them, and they didn't smile much. And you have that, too, with quite a lot of the rock and roll singers that were coming along in the 50s, too. Some of them, of course, were full of fun and life, like Little Richard, but not a great deal of them. And I think he was someone, same with David Bowie, you're presenting the works seriously, you don't want to smile for the public. He didn't like publicity photographs being taken very much. There's a very nice story on the 1965 tour where Harry Goodwin, who was the Top of the Pops photographer for the BBC, was sent to get some pictures of Bob Dylan, because even though Bob Dylan wasn't appearing on the Top of the Pops programme, his records were in the charts, and they had a chart rundown. They wanted photos of him for the programme. So they asked Harry to go to Sheffield to take some pictures of him. And when he got to the theatre, Dylan said that he didn't want to be snapped. But Harry got his camera out and got his flashlight, and he flashed it on him twice, which caused Dylan to whirl around, wonder what was happening. And in that moment, he got actually a classic picture of Dylan, which is on the front of the book.
One of the other great influences that you identify on Bob Dylan is John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. And as soon as I read that, I thought, yes, of course, there is so much of that Dust Bowl portraiture in Dylan's work. He is a great reader, by all accounts.
He is, yes. He likes reading books, certainly, and was certainly influenced by John Steinbeck's novel. And indeed, Steinbeck's novel is really a companion piece to Woody Guthrie's songs. You can see how they complement each other very, very well. And Bruce Springsteen's very keen on John Steinbeck as well, and he's been influenced by The Grapes of Wrath. And so you've got quite a bit of material that has emanated from that book.
And of course, Dylan has written his own book, Tarantula, 1966, I think, which is famously impenetrable, makes Ulysses look like a walk in the park.
Well, Ulysses by James Joyce isn't too bad. It's Finnegan's Wake that's the terrible one. And Dylan's Tarantula is a bit along those lines. It probably helps if you've had a few naughty substances before you actually tackle the book, really. It's images all over the place, images for their own sake. And Dylan, he wrote it because he was given the contract to do a book, and then decided he didn't want to publish it and dropped it. And it turned out the bootleg copies were around. I had a bootleg copy about 1967. In fact, I can still see it there on my bookshelves now. So it was circulating amongst the fans. There were some nice images in it, images that could easily have fit in any of his songs, but I really hadn't a clue what it was about. It was a bit like the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour. I mean, nobody really knew what that film was about either. But he was getting something out of his system. And in fact, once he'd done it, he stopped these songs with all these wild images and everything and had started writing different types of songs. And then at the end of the 60s, he was writing pretty straight country music.
And of course, he famously won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2016. And I sense from your book that you fully concur with that decision. You do feel that he is one of the great writers of the 20th century, notwithstanding Tarantula.
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody has their off days. And when you've written as much as he has and has published as much as he has, you've had quite a few off days. But there is so much magnificent stuff there. And I think that if someone is trying new things all the time and going in different directions, some of them are bound to fail. So there's nothing wrong with making mistakes. I think you'll find that most great artists have made mistakes along the way. But his body of work is quite substantial, and you can't think of another songwriter who would get the Nobel Prize for Literature, really, from this kind of generation. I suppose Leonard Cohen would have been someone. Stephen Sondheim, completely different sort of music, he'd be someone else who could have been in line for it. But I think it was a very good decision to give it to Bob Dylan. I think it was well deserved. And it was interesting that he was somewhat flattered himself as he did give a speech to the Nobel Committee, which is unlike him. Although, having said that, when he got an Oscar for Times Have Changed, I saw him in Liverpool then, that was the mid-90s, and he actually came on stage and held his Oscar up to the audience. It may have been, of course, that he'd heard that Liverpool was a den of thieves or something and didn't want to leave it backstage, who knows. But he certainly held it up to the audience, and I thought it was such an extraordinary moment. I mean, it's a very un-Dylan-like thing to do. But on the other hand, because it's an un-Dylan-like thing to do, it becomes a very Dylan-like thing to do.
Pete Seeger had told Bob that Anthea Joseph had been excellent at promoting his concert at the Royal Albert Hall. On the next day, he went to the Troubadour Folk Club in Old Brompton Road, and Anthea recognised him from the cover of Sing Out. She told him he could come in for nothing if he sang. The audience was unsure about how to take his voice, but many of them loved it. Dylan was introduced to the blues guitarist, Alexis Corner. Madhouse on Castle Street was a play written by the white Jamaican playwright Evan Jones. It was a bleak kitchen sink drama about the fate of a lodger who has locked himself in his room. Shades of Paul Simon's A Most Peculiar Man? Dylan dutifully went to the read-through on December 19th and decided it was not for him. He could learn the lyrics of hundreds of songs, but learning lines, even only a few, didn't interest him. He felt uncomfortable, and he told Philip Saville, "Why can't I just be a singer?" They reached a compromise. Evan Jones would split the role of Lenny into two. David Warner, then with the Royal Shakespeare Company, would say the words, leaving Bob with just one line. "Well, I don't know. I'll have to go home and think about it."
Now, your book, Outlaw Blues, is full of wonderful anecdotes like that. And I know you interviewed over 300 friends, acquaintances and fellow musicians of Dylan's. Do you have a couple of favourite anecdotes that you'd like to share with us to whet our appetites for the audiobook version?
It's very nice to speak to people like John Byers, who played such an important part in his life, and Judy Collins, too. Judy Collins told me a wonderful story that she was doing something with Bob Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, and Bob Dylan was at Albert Grossman's house also that night as well. And she said in the middle of the night, she heard someone singing quietly, and she thought she'd go and see what it was. And she went downstairs, and she said from by the side of the door was shut, and she didn't go in because she didn't want to disturb him. She could hear Bob Dylan working on a new song, which turned out to be Mr. Tambourine Man. So she was very definitely the first person to hear it. And she said she was very glad that she didn't go in and say, "Hi, Bob, what are you doing?" Because he was just in the middle of that really creative period.
And as we said earlier, he continues to record. He released three brilliant new singles in 2020 and a very well-received double album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. And I believe he's going to be touring again this year.
I think so. Well, I think all the artists have to, because they've got all these commitments prior to COVID. They have to do them now.
And I suppose he was in the middle of his never-ending tour when COVID came along.
Yeah, well, he certainly had some dates that had to be cancelled, yes. And so you got to one of those bookings first, really. But who knows what he will be doing next or what he'll be writing next. His voice isn't anything like what it was, I don't think. You know, he croaks his way through his songs these days. But I think he's found a way, like Kris Kristofferson in many ways, of being able to use a limited voice now to still get his stories across. And I think the last album, which had its first number one single in America with Murder Most Foul, worked really well. So I'd expect to have more of that. A few years ago, I think he'd realised that he couldn't sing as well as he was, and there was a fantastic song that he wrote that he gave to Sheryl Crow, and she did a very good version of it, and then he decided to do his own version. And I thought at the time, oh, what he's going to do now is write songs and give them to the performer that he thinks will do it best, which would be a very valid way of working. But in fact, I think he's given up on that idea and deciding to do things himself. And I look forward to his next album because his lyrics are certainly as brilliant as ever.
As I mentioned in my introduction, you have written an enormous range of books, biographies of Simon and Garfunkel, Elvis Presley, several books on the Beatles. And I notice you've...
Well,
also...
I come from Liverpool.
Well, it's in the blood, indeed. I also noticed that you have co-authored a book on 1,000 UK number one hits. What do you think is the secret of having a number one hit?
You've got to have something that will appeal to people at all levels, I think. Bob Dylan, on the whole, didn't have very big hit records because there was a whole tranche of people who weren't interested in Bob Dylan and switched off, as it were. The Beatles, I think, were perfect all-rounders. They could do everything. They have records that appeal to people who are musicians. They are intellectual. They were bright. And yet they could appeal just to the person who was hearing a track on the bus. It could be sung at dances, you know, all sorts of things. So they created just wonderful hit records, I think. In the book, you look at the songs there, and they've nearly all got good tunes, good melodies. And it's only in later years, in recent times, you know, where you have a lot of tracks that don't have any melody at all because people are just rapping them. And then people aren't going to remember them 10 years later. But a lot of the music of the 1960s, for example, it's endured to now. And I think that's because you had Bob Dylan, the Beatles, you had the Beach Boys, Jimmy Webb, Brown Wilson, Ray Davies, all these people working at the same time. And they wanted to be better. They wanted to be better the next time when they did something. And they wanted to be better than what the other people were doing as well. So they were trying to keep on top of things. And the songs that came out are just marvellous. And some of them are quite unlike any songs that have been written before. I mean, take Jimmy Webb's MacArthur Park. Never been a song like that before. And again, with Jimmy Webb, which it's a lineman, the guy who's mending the telephone wires, and he's up there and he's thinking about his girlfriend. It's such a simple image and it's brilliant. And these are astounding songs. And people were writing great songs all the time. Admittedly, some people tried to sort of rip off Bob Dylan or copy what Bob Dylan was doing and made a terrible mess of it. But even Barry McGuire's Even Destruction does have some charm about it.
I've always felt that the best songs are miniature short stories that conjure up lasting images and put them to music.
Well, indeed, and you got that in Randy Newman. Very concise, sharp songs. And there's an example of a very different songwriter who takes on the characters in his songs and sings the songs as that character. So that some people have got the wrong idea of songs like Short People and the like. But that's a very interesting way of songwriting, and nobody was doing that before him. And he was against someone coming along the same time as the other people. And it just meant it was such a creative time.
That's an interesting thought, yes. Randy Newman as an early example of a story narrator taking on the various different voices of the characters. Spencer Lee, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Outlaw Blues by Spencer Lee is available from RNIB Talking Books. It's narrated by Philip Pope and runs for 32 hours and 9 minutes.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Simon & Schuster have donated another book by Santa Montefiore, one of our readers' favourite writers. This one is called Wait For Me.
Reverend Miller was a diminutive figure in the pulpit, and yet his exuberance gave the impression that he was much bigger. His bald head was as shiny as a billiard ball, his cheeks the rosy pink of a choir boy's, and his eyebrows were bushy and came to life when he spoke, like a pair of inebriated caterpillars. His lisp might have been comic, had the words he articulated been less passionate and wise. Reverend Miller was a truly inspirational vicar, and held captive every member of his congregation, except for one. Florence Lightfoot sat in the middle of the pew alongside her grandparents, Joan and Henry Pinfold, her uncle Raymond, sister Winifred, and mother Margaret. While her family sat with their backs straight and their attention fixed upon the vicar, Florence's attention had long since strayed across the aisle to where the Dash family was sitting with equal formality on the other side. She pretended to listen to Reverend Miller, every now and then giving a little nod or a chuckle to show how engrossed she was. But in truth, she heard only noise without meaning, for every ounce of her focus was trained upon 19-year-old Aubrey.
Cornwall, 1944. When Rupert Dash is declared missing, presumed dead, during the Battle of Arnhem, his wife Florence is devastated. She can't accept that he's gone from her life forever, and so when she finds a poem called Wait for Me hidden in an old book, she believes it's a sign from her husband, a promise that he will return to her. London, 1988. Since childhood, Max has suffered from a recurring nightmare. Surrounded by the horrific chaos of war, he has an urgent mission he knows he must complete. But time after time, the dream ends with him awaking in terror, his heart pounding from the horror of the battlefield. Desperate to understand why he is haunted by such terrible visions, Max embarks on a journey that leads him to Cornwall and a man named Rupert Dash. Melbourne, 1995. Florence receives a letter from someone she's never met, who lives on the other side of the world. This stranger says he remembers a life that belonged to another before him. Could this be the one person Florence has waited 51 years to meet again?
Florence had what her sensible older sister deemed a crush. Florence, who was 17 and three quarters, knew it was more than that. A crush implied something temporary and juvenile, like a childish penchant for dolls, which one quickly grows out of and deeply regrets. What Florence felt for Aubrey Dash was infinitely deeper, and would, she knew, endure. She could not imagine ever falling out of love with him. For love is what it was, she was certain. She'd read enough novels to recognise love when she felt it. Aubrey did not look at Florence. He sat rigidly, with the same serious expression as the rest of the congregation, until he smiled at something the vicar said, and then his face creased around his mouth and eyes, and he laughed. The sight of him smiling had an extraordinary effect on Florence. It lifted her up and caused a blissful expansion to take place in her chest, rather similar to a religious experience, which would have greatly encouraged the vicar had he noticed it.
Wait for Me by Santa Montefiore is read by Georgina Sutton and Joe Eyre, and runs for 11 hours and 3 minutes.
Next we have The Showman, the inside story of Ukraine and the war that made a leader of Zelensky, by Simon Schuster, which was donated to us by HarperCollins.
Volodymyr Zelensky felt no deep attachment to the home he left behind when the invasion started. For a year and a half, it served as a convenient place for him and his family to live, with a separate house on the grounds for their bodyguards and a few acres of land to run the dogs till they were tired. On a normal day, his trip home from work would take less than 30 minutes from the center of Kyiv, just far enough to escape the noise of the city and breathe clean air before going to bed. But the house itself, with a neoclassical facade of yellow stone, situated on lot number 29 in the gated community of Concha Zaspa, seemed overly grand to the former comedian, bordering on ostentatious. It felt, in a word, too presidential for Zelensky.
Based on 4 years of reporting, extensive travels with President Zelensky to the front, and dozens of interviews with him, his wife, his friends and enemies, his advisers, ministers and military commanders, the showman tells an intimate and eye-opening story of the president's evolution from a slapstick actor to a symbol of resilience, revealing how he managed to rally the world's democracies behind his cause. Clear-eyed about the president's early failures as a peacemaker and his willingness to silence political dissent, the book offers a complex picture of a man struggling to break what he sees as an historical cycle of oppression that began generations before he was born. Even as the war drags on, Zelensky lays out his vision for its future course and through his actions demonstrates his strategy for countering the Russians and keeping the West on his side. The result is a riveting, up-close picture of the invasion as experienced by its number one target and improbable hero.
It also made him seem like a hypocrite. When he took office in the spring of 2019, at the age of 41, the president made a promise not to live in the properties reserved for government officials in Ukraine, especially not the one in Konchazaspa. Among the most palatial of the bunch, its floor plan featured a billiard room, a home theater, and a separate wing with an indoor pool beneath an elegant glass dome. Previous heads of state had used the villa and filled it with gaudy furniture. Zelensky, in his career as a comedian, mocked them for it. "Guys, how about we let some kids live in these residences?" he said while running for president. It's like when you travel around Europe on those tours and you see the old residences of some big kings, he said. What is that now? It's all for touring. Yet, here he was, not touring these rooms, but living in them, coming home each day through an entrance where a pair of lions sat carved in stone, life-sized, their color matching the columns of the portico. Here he was greeting his kids beneath the soaring entryway and climbing the marble staircase to his bedroom. For a man who had spent his entire life as an actor, capable of switching roles as quickly as his stagehands could change the scenery for his next sketch, Zelensky chafed at the big and kingly role of president. It grated against the persona he had spent decades cultivating on the screen and stage. The grinning gagman, the tireless charmer, the back-slapping believer that all would be right with the world in the end.
The Showman, the inside story of Ukraine and the war that made a leader of Zelensky, by Simon Schuster, is read by Daniel Gamberg and runs for 14 hours, 26 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, instead of books of your life, let's talk to Phil Jupitus. We recorded this outside at the Wigtown Book Festival, possibly too close to Bill Drummond from the KLF, who was making a bed.
Sorry, we're near a wood shop.
It's Bill Drummond.
Right, is it Bill Drummond?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, look at him. That is the sound of Bill Drummond hammering. That is amazing. This is the best heckle I've ever had. This is actually... This is not someone making a bed. This is art terrorism you're listening to there, kids. Oh, man. Anyway, so, yeah, this is fabulous.
Now, what was your first talk on today?
We went through sort of... It was kind of, in a way, almost like my sort of Desert Island books, but it was just a look at... half a dozen of my favourite books and authors, with Lee Randall, the journalist and author herself, and she's an old mate of mine, and we've always sort of talked quite sort of impassioned terms about writers and things that we like. And I think I've got a very immediate way of expressing ideas, which is when you're a stand-up comedian, you get a very kind of unvarnished and unconsidered way of expressing your thoughts. And it's very immediate and it's very blunt from that standpoint. And so the kind of luxury of writing is something that you kind of look at with a green eye. Certainly, it's like, I could never imagine what it would be like to write. And when someone writes brilliantly, like, I mean, we talked about Raymond Chandler today and Dickens and Dorothy Parker and all sorts of people, you know, A.A. Milne even, you know, who I was first introduced to as a child. They're all very, very stylish writers. You could pick a paragraph of any of those writers' work and it would be immediately recognisable as them, I feel, you know. And I suppose that's what I like, is it almost, if you read it out loud, it's, I mean, there was a bit today, I randomly picked a paragraph of Damon Runyon and read it out and it got a massive laugh. Just because it's so evocative, you know, of that New York of the 20s, that kind of villains arena, you know, those kind of characters that he's writing about are murderers and thugs and vandals and whores and drug addicts. And he just makes them sound so affable. It's extraordinary, really. And so, yeah, I suppose the theme that I recognise by picking my writers is I like the writers that in a way are performers. You know, there's an immediacy to them. Dickens certainly used to read his stuff out to crowds. And he was almost like James Brown. He used to come off stage and claps Dickens after readings. He was quite the show queen. So yeah. I like that. I'm drawn to it. I read a little excerpt from the Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens.
That this association has heard read with feelings of unmingled satisfaction and unqualified approval, the paper communicated by Samuel Pickwick Esquire, G.C. M.P.C. General Chairman of Member Pickwick Club, entitled Speculations on the Source of the Hampstead Ponds, with some observations on the theory of tittlebats. And that this association does hereby return its warmest thanks to the said Samuel Pickwick Esquire, G.C. M.P.C. for the same.
I also was looking at the collected Dorothy Parker.
She wanted to be married. She was nearing 30 now, and she did not take the years well. She spread and softened, and her darkening hair turned her to inexpert dabblings with peroxide. There were times when she had little flashes of fear about her job. And she had had a couple of thousand evenings of being a good sport among her male acquaintances. She had come to be more conscientious than spontaneous about it.
And Damon Runyon, I mean, obviously, Guys and Dolls and Other Stories was the book that we read from today. We took a little bit from.
She keeps the letters in a big inlaid box in her room, Mr. Tuesday says. And if you just pick up this box and carry it away along with the silverware, no one will ever suspect that you are after the letters.
Also, in terms of more modern writers, the American poet Billy Collins. I read from his collection Aimless Love. I've got to get the order right. Is it music, 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 clothes, 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 boys, boys, boys? I think it's that order by Viv Albertine. It may be boys, boys, boys. I don't think boys were first. I think boys were last. It might have been clothes, clothes, clothes before it was music, music, music. But that book is, and you'll forgive me for saying, fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. So, yeah, it's... It was great to sort of read from that as well. And, of course, the collected sort of World of Pooh, which is the Winnie the Pooh and House at Pooh Corner collected edition. I'm still very, very fond of that book.
He hurried back to his own house, and his mind was so busy on the way with the hum that he was getting ready for Eeyore that when he suddenly saw Piglet sitting in his best armchair, he could only stand there rubbing his head and wondering whose house he was in. "Hello, Piglet," he said. "I thought you were out." "No," said Piglet. "It's you who are out, Pooh."
"As a child, how did you consume Pooh?"
a little moment there just for the listeners. how did you... My mum read it to me at first, and so this is... So I was born in 62, and so as a young child in the 60s. This is the days before... audiobooks. I mean, as a parent in the 90s, my kids had, you know, little sort of cassette players in their bedrooms and listened to audiobooks. We had the Alan Bennett, Winnie the Poohs, and I think one of the Willie Rushton ones as well, you know. But I never had those as a kid, not even records when they came out. You know, by the time the idea of listening to someone reading The idea of someone else reading stories out, you know, it was... I don't remember there being albums of people reading stories out being a very popular seller in record shops, but I think when cassettes came along and they were more portable, and then CDs, I think the rise of the audiobook in the last 20 years has been one of the most extraordinary things, you know. But although I have to say, I mustn't listen to them in cars because they're quite sort of soporific. Certainly, Philip Pullman reading his books out, I mean, they're brilliant and they're amazing, but as soon as he says Pantalaimon, I'm asleep. And he says her name quite early in that first book. And another author, I love authors when they read in their own voice, and so you can find a bit of Dorothy Parker online reading her stuff out, which is lovely. And there's a great American author who we didn't talk about today who writes really good non-fiction stuff called Sarah Vowell. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with her because she contributes to an NPR show in America called This American Life, which is really, really good. But she has a fabulous audiobook that it's one of those ones that I listen to a lot over and over again. I'm quite drawn to it. She has a very strange quality to her voice. She was the daughter in The Incredibles, for those of you that are film-minded out there. She did the voice for her. But Sarah Vowell's book, Assassination Vacation, is absolutely brilliant. And it's a very wittily told story of... It's the story of Lincoln and Garfield and the subsequent president's assassinations, three presidential assassinations in a row that happened sort of in the 1800s and into the 20th century. And what she does is she goes on holiday looking for all the various relics, and she goes to the places where these assassinations took place. So she goes to the location of the Ford's Theatre in Washington, where Lincoln was shot, and you know, she even travels the escape route that Booth took with a broken leg up to Dr. Mudd's house. You know, when I listen to audiobooks, historical stuff fascinates me, you know, really does.
Thanks once again to Phil Jupitus. That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.